Okie doke. Judges chapter 12. Let's go ahead and start by reading our text. Well, I'll bring everybody up to speed just in case we've kind of forgotten. It's been a couple of weeks since we last looked at chapter 11. We're really bringing Jephthah to a close, and it's quite a sad story. When you go back how Israel was being oppressed by the Ammonites, and they suffered oppression at the hands of the Ammonites, who were on the east of the Jordan River, persecuting Gilead specifically, for 18 years. And God heard their cry finally and raised up for them a judge by the name of Jephthah. And find out just Jephthah had a hard life from the beginning. He was the son of a harlot. He was ran out by his brothers. He was unwanted, forced to make a living as a bandit of some sort. He's called a valiant man of war, too. And it's he who finally receives the Spirit of the Lord and is able to deliver the children of Israel from the Ammonites in a victory. The only problem, he made a vow to God and said, if you'll give me victory over the Ammonites, and the first thing that comes from my house, whenever I return home victorious, I'll give back to you. And the language is a little unclear. We're not sure whether, as his daughter came out to meet him, was the first thing that came out, whether he killed her and gave her as a burnt offering, which the text kind of leads us to think that. But he also used some very ambiguous language that doesn't allow us to say with 100% certainty that that was his daughter's fate. He may have sent her to serve the Lord in some other manner. So those are the two primary ideas. But regardless, a very sad story about a man who suffered a lot of loss, simply wanted to have his name continued throughout the history books of the Israelites, and so he vowed away the most important thing that he had, the only hope that he had of continuing his name, and ends up losing his daughter. We saw last week the confrontation, and this is after the battle and the deliverance from the Israelites. We saw trouble on the outside, now we're looking at trouble on the inside. As the Ephraimites, who have opposed Jephthah's leadership, they see it's kind of beginning to grow and his influence is starting to grow a little bit. They go and they say, why didn't you ask us to go to battle? And Jephthah says, I did ask you to go to battle, but you didn't help me. When I saw that you weren't going to help me, I took my life into my own hands, and the Lord delivered the Ammonites to me. And so Ephraim just wouldn't back down, wouldn't relent. And so 42,000 Ephraimites died as they were trying to go to war against Jephthah and dethrone him, if you will. At least, maybe after the initial battle, they died as they tried to return back home, crossing the Jordan. And so a very sad story there. Not only does Jephthah lose his daughter, but you see almost an entire tribe wiped out as a result of their pride and their arrogance. So that's where we're going to be picking up with this story this morning. Let's go ahead and read verses 1 through 7. Brother Arnold, would you mind reading that text for us, please? Chapter 12, verses 1 through 7. All right. Thank you, Ronnie. So let's just start with our fifth question. I believe it's our fifth question. Yep, I went a little too far there. In the first seven verses, we're finishing up with Jephthah, and pretty soon we're going to move on to the latter portion of the chapter. All right, question five, if you're following along, see if we can get some discussion going so y'all don't have to listen to me lecture the entire time. What do you, well, and I should say, what do you believe? What was Jephthah's greatest gift? He's a man of many talents. What do you think was his greatest gift? He's a good military leader. For better or for worse, he might have been a man of integrity to a fault. If you take that belief that he killed his daughter and offered her as a burnt offering, well, one way or the other, whether he killed her and offered her as a burnt offering or whether he sent her to serve the Lord in some other way, he honored his word. When we looked, I guess the week before last, at some of the ways that Jephthah could have averted that crisis by having redeemed her or having admitted the vow was reckless and paid a fee to have that vow removed and to have kept his daughter. Regardless of the case, he honored his word. But you remember, it was really his daughter that pushed him forth and made him do it. She was the one that said, "Father, you made a vow. God delivered the Ammonites. You need to keep it." And so he kept his word. So he's a man of honor. He's a valiant man. Does he have any other talents? Okay. Gave God the glory. So he says, you know, when you wouldn't help me, I took my life into my own hands and God delivered me from the hands of the Ammonites. So he pointed the people toward God. He didn't take the claim for himself. Miss Johnny? Okay. Right. And personally, I believe that was his greatest gift. You know, if you think about a little boy growing up, what's a little boy want to be? He'd rather be a general. He'd rather be the one who's leading the people. And so we know Jephthah was a valiant warrior. Not many kids want to grow up to be diplomats. But I think really the diplomacy that Jephthah possessed was the greatest gift that he had. So Miss Johnny mentioned on two occasions, he spends the greater portion of chapter 11 going through four or five different arguments in an attempt to make peace with the Ammonites. He goes back and presents all of these logical arguments about why they really didn't have any claim to the land that they were trying to intrude upon in Israel. And so he very diplomatically deals with them. And rather than just, you know, pulling out his sword and saying, "Let's go to battle," he tries to pursue for peace. And then we see that that's the same way with the Ephraimites. He deals with them in the same way. He tries to make peace with them. He tries to communicate with them, but Ephraim refused to back down. And as a result of that, they forced him to go to war. And so he demonstrates this ability of diplomacy, but he also was a valiant man. And I suppose if your enemies refuse to play into your diplomacy for peace, then it's a good ability to have to be able to fall back on that those valiant warrior skills. And so, ironically, while I believe the power of his words were his greatest gift, it was also his downfall, wasn't it? That vow that he made. So he promised the Lord whatever came from his house, he would give it, and it ended up being his daughter. So although he did possess a great degree of diplomacy, and he used his tongue and the power of words very effectively, it also brought about his downfall with his daughter and the result of that. We also see here with Jephthah, you see a picture of imperfect salvation. You've got this problem of the Ammonites oppressing the Israelites for some 18 years, and they need deliverance. And so the solution? Raise up a judge. Bring forth a judge, and the Lord does just that. And as a result of Jephthah being raised up, you have deliverance from the Ammonites. But so oftentimes whenever God uses fickle man and fallible man to bring about his salvation, you have somewhat of a salvation is tinctured by human arrogance. And although, yes, their repression was removed, they were saved, if you will, a man is left without a child, however you want to interpret that. 42,000 men are left dead from the tribe of Ephraim. And so even though they won, and the salvation that they so desperately needed was granted, it was tinctured by the arrogance of humans. And so you have there this picture of imperfect salvation. And that's how perfect salvation really contrasts with God's use of men. You know, you see Jesus, who was God, came to this earth. And yes, he lived as a man, but he's the only one that could orchestrate the perfect plan of salvation. When you see God trying to use others, and it's not the failings of God, it's always, always the failings of man that cause the salvation God's attempting to bring to them to really go askew. And others have tried to interrupt God's salvation before. Satan tried to do it. Peter tried to do it with Jesus. He tried to interrupt God's plan. We talked a little bit about that this morning. And the Pharisees tried to interrupt the salvation of God through a system of good works. When man tries to help God out in accomplishing God's will, so oftentimes it really causes things to go astray. However, sovereign God, omnipotent God, all-knowing God is still able to use human weakness to bring about his overall plan. So let's talk just very briefly, something a little larger scale as we take a step back and look at this picture of the book of Judges as a whole. The first three major judges that we were introduced to, Othniel, Ehud, and Deborah and Barak. When you go back and you'll remember their accounts, there's not a lot negative. In fact, there's nothing negative that's really said about them. We know the little issue with Barak's doubting, but nothing nearly as negative as what we read about in the next three judges. We think about Gideon, Jephthah, and Samson. Gideon, you'll remember, yes, his victory against the... who was it, Gideon? Gideon was victorious over, was it the Midianites, I believe? It was the Midianites. After his victory, he leads the children of Israel into harlotry with the golden ephod that he makes. Jephthah, he delivers them from the Ammonites, but Ephraim is left almost without a clan, without a man, and he loses his daughter in the process. As we're going to find out, I'm sure we all know the general story of Samson, how there's a lot of things that go wrong with Samson's ruler as position as judge. But you got nothing negative said about the first three. You got a lot negative said about the last three. And really, I think what the book overall is trying to show us is Israel's not so much in this cycle of sin, but they're digressing. It's getting worse and worse and worse. You know, there's nothing bad said about the first three judges. It wasn't a perfect plan, but nothing major negative said. But the last three, there's a lot that's brought out by the narrator as far as their imperfection and their faults. So it's not so much to say Israel is repeating itself. Rather, Israel is digressing. And we're going to see that really at the end of the book as we look at how truly wicked and how truly evil Israel had become. So a couple correlations we may have noticed between Jephthah and Jesus. Both were men that were despised and rejected. Both of men that brought salvation, although that were completely different. Salvation brought by Jephthah was tainted with imperfection and laws, but salvation brought by Jesus was full and perfect. So with that concluding remark, we bring our study of Jephthah to a close. Does anybody else want to bring any other thoughts, comments, or questions about Jephthah before we move on to some of the minor judges that verses 8 through 15 are going to talk about for a few moments? All right, well, let's go ahead and look at this latter portion of chapter 12. There's some challenging names and challenging places that are found here. Does we have any takers on wanting to read that? If not, I'll muddle my way through it. All right, let's read verses 8 through 15. Make an attempt to. Now, Ibzan of Bethlehem judged Israel after him. He had 30 sons and 30 daughters whom he gave in marriage outside the family, and he brought in 30 daughters from outside for his sons. And he judged Israel 7 years. And then Ibzan died and was buried in Bethlehem. Now Elon, the Zebulunite, judged Israel after him, and he judged Israel 10 years. Then Elon, the Zebulunite, died and was buried in Ajalon in the land of Zebulun. Now Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Pirathonite, judged Israel after him. He had 40 sons and 30 grandsons who rode on 70 donkeys, and he judged Israel 8 years. Then Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Pirathonite, died and was buried at Pirathon, in the land of Ephraim, in the hill country of the Amalekites. All right, so believe it or not, there are actually a couple of questions and a couple of thoughts that I'd like to share from these verses here. You come to portions of Scripture like this, and you really got to wring it real tight sometimes to find something. Like with the story of Jephthah, there's just full of lessons and full of things to talk about, full of things to dive into that you just catch your interest on the surface. But then you get to some of these more boring. It's the best way we can probably describe it. There's not a lot of action here in this just summary life of these three minor judges. But there are some things that I believe are worth our consideration. We have three minor judges here that are described for us. Ibzan in verses 8 through 10, what we're told about him, his legacy. He had 30 sons and daughters, and he judged Israel 7 years. Elon in verses 11 and 12 from the tribe of Zebulun judged Israel 10 years. And Abdon in verses 13 through 15, 40 sons and 30 grandsons who rode 70 donkeys. And he judged Israel 8 years. So we do want to take a break and kind of take a step back at Jephthah as we understand maybe part of why the narrator included this information to us, we may scratch our head and say, well, what is there? Why is this important for us to know? Let's make a little comparison and contrast. What contrast can be noticed between Jair, Jephthah, and Ibzan? Did anybody really chase that out to see if you could find any correlation between them? Okay. Okay. That's what I was looking for. So you go back, and if you remember the list of judges, before Jephthah's story came along, we had, I believe it was two minor judges that were just very briefly mentioned. And so you got this minor judge, Jair, before Jephthah's story. You got Jephthah, and then after him, you've got Ibzan. So Jephthah sandwiched in between two minor judges. And the question, what contrast can be noticed between Jair, Jephthah, and Ibzan? Jair, as Tommy mentioned, is really the number of children, the progeny that they had. Jair had 30 sons back in chapter 10 and verse 4. Jephthah had a single daughter, the text points out in Judges 11:34. Ibzan, one of the minor judges that follows immediately after Jephthah, 30 sons and 30 daughters. You think about that. It causes you to stop and question, why does it seem maybe that God withholds from some and gives very graciously to others? I think that's a question that we may oftentimes ask in our life, you know, in just various areas, whether it comes to children or health or finances. Why does it seem that God's very gracious and very appreciative of some, and on others he seems to really withhold blessings? Maybe Jephthah would have wondered. If he was familiar with Israel's history, then he probably knew that there are many people were more blessed when it came to the number of children and the size of their family that they had. So why does God choose to bless certain people and seem to withhold from others? Well, that kind of delves us into this idea of perhaps the providence of God. And this idea is manifested not just here in Jephthah's story and the two surrounding judges. You think about God's deliverance of Jesus from Herod. Now, we know God had a plan for Jesus. But Jesus was born, and Herod found out about it. The king of the Jews was being born, and so he says to the wise men, let me know so that I can go worship him. Well, remember, God divinely intervenes, and he comes to Joseph, Mary's husband, and he says, Herod's going to kill all the baby boys. You need to get out of town. And so he's warned to take Jesus and flee. We know God has a bigger plan. However, what about all the other young boys in Bethlehem that died? What about all the other toddlers, two and under, that lost their life because of this bloodthirsty man and his fear that another king was going to rise up? Why didn't God save them? Why didn't God warn them that this travesty was about to take place and that they needed to flee as well? Why was an individual spared and yet all of the rest were, the families were left in shambles? You remember Peter? Whenever he was in prison, God delivered him. An angel came to him and let him out of the gate. And he was locked down in the innermost cell. And this angel comes, and Peter thinks he's having a dream, and he kind of follows him outside the city gate to the house where these Christians are at. God delivered Peter. But you remember the very event before that, you got the Apostle James. He was just beheaded by Herod. And Herod saw how happy that made everybody, and he said, well, I can get Peter as well. I'll do the same thing to him, and that'll build my popularity. Why did God allow James to die? Why did God free Peter from prison? Why do some people live perfectly healthy lives and others struggle with their health all throughout? Why does God give a great number of children to some families and withhold them from others? You know, there aren't always good answers. And I think that this is one of the lessons maybe the narrator's trying to help subtly communicate to us. Jephthah was sandwiched between two judges that had 30 children and 40 children. Jephthah had a single daughter. Why does it work that way sometimes? We can't always answer. We can't always know. Dick, you want to make a comment?
Another contrast, it might not be as important as that one, but Jephthah was more or less an outcast that was brought in to be a judge versus the other two. They were kind of part of it.
Okay. We don't know a whole lot about him, but Jephthah, we do know, wasn't really received well initially versus the others who were just told that they judged and seemed to have somewhat of a success. The land had peace during the time of their judgeship. So that's another contrast that can be made between Jephthah and Abdon and Ibzan. But, you know, back to this idea about why does God give to some and why does God take away from others? And sometimes we're just left. That's honestly asking that question. Why? Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 28. And It's not always an answer that's satisfying because we want to know the why. We talked about that in a sermon a couple weeks back. You know, why do people just suffer travesty and tragedy? Why are some people blessed and why are others not, as it seems? And it boils down to this idea. Isaiah says in Isaiah 40 and verse 28, "Do you not know? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, does not become weary or tired. His understanding is inscrutable." Some versions say his understanding is unsearchable. That's the reality of it, is that God has this much broader perspective than we do. And yes, he looks at our life independently. And he knows when we hurt. And he knows when we're upset. And he knows when we're plagued by loss. And others around us, it seems like the song we sing, you know, there many are being blessed and the wicked are being blessed, while it seems like God's people are cast down and are suffering in contrast. But Isaiah says the understanding of God is unsearchable. And God is able to see things we can't. He's able to see the big picture. He's able to see this world and its schemes and everything that's going to happen. And we have to come to a conclusion, come to peace with the fact that we're baffled by God's providence. It's not for us to know. It's for us to trust. And it's for us to have faith. Why did Jephthah only have one daughter when everybody else had around him seemed to have plenty of children? And why did he end up losing that? Well, we understand that was the result of his decision. And oftentimes, we also need to understand our loss, our suffering, and our hurt is the result of our poor decisions. But sometimes also, it's out of our control as well. And so, we don't like being without an explanation. But faith, if need be, needs to be baffled, it's willing to do so. And even when it's dark, it'll bow down and it will worship God. I think that's one of the things that we see. We look at Jephthah and the surrounding judges. We sometimes wonder.
One thought on that, not understanding it. That's one of my favorite songs that we sing is Farther Along.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it says, Farther Along will understand why, you know, and cheer up my brother.
Right. And that was a song I was very feebly alluding to earlier when I made the statement that others are blessed, others continue to prosper year after year while, you know, we're just kind of trudging along. And that's the idea behind that song. It's a very human question, and it's very, very applicable, and it's one I'm sure probably all of us have asked, and if you haven't asked it at some point in time in your life, you will. You know, why is this happening to me? So, Brother Barker, were you wanting to make a comment? I think that's a good point. You know, contentment is obviously what we're to strive for. The Apostle Paul has some good things to say about that. But I really appreciate how you bring out, you know, because that's something challenging to struggle with. When you look at everybody else, and it's just a tendency of human beings to compare. You know, my job versus his job, my car versus his car, my house versus his house, you know, my family, my health, my money, this, that, or the other. We just have this tendency to compare. And Dave, you brought out something I believe is just very important in finding contentment, which the Bible says that Christians are to be content. In whatever circumstance I am in, I am to be content. That's from the mouth of Paul, who wrote that from prison. But to find contentment, and it's not an easy thing to do, you've got to have this long-term perspective. If we're focused on the things that are here, and we're focused on the money, and we're focused on the health, and yes, those things are important, and yes, those things affect our faith, and yes, they affect our loved ones, and yes, it's challenging sometimes to deal with struggles in those areas. But when we focus on the long-term, then all of those other things kind of just have a tendency to drift aside. And that doesn't mean that it's not going to be hard and it's not going to hurt. But that's how you do find contentment ultimately, I believe, is maintain that long-term perspective. Johnny? I think it's Isaiah 55, and Jim quotes it quite often, is God's ways are above ours. And his understanding is beyond ours. His depth of knowledge and his perspective is simply out of reach. We live in the moment. We live for the future, but we live in the moment. God exists in the moment, and there's nothing but the present with God. And so, you know, this moment, God's here right now. And an hour from now, that's present for God. And the end of my life, that's present for God. And the end of the world, that's present for God. He exists in the moment. And so he's able to, you know, it's like us watching a movie. And you see all of these events unfolding, and yeah, you can see what something's bad about to happen to somebody, and you know, you watch a movie and you see it 100 times, and you know something bad's about to happen, but yet you always hope it's going to be different. Well, it's like our life, the existence of this world from beginning to end, is a movie for God. He exists in the moment. He knows everything that's going to happen, you know, before it ever does, for us, anyways. You're right. And I think that's how he prefaces that statement. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. You know, when you boil it out all down, and y'all have heard me say this, and you'll continue to hear me say this, you know, at the end of your life, what's going to be the most important? When you boil it all down, it isn't going to matter how much money you made or how successful you were at your job or the size of the house you lived in. You're not going to look back at those things and wish for more of those. As Danny brought out, Ecclesiastes really boils it all down where it says, fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. And at the end of our days, when we're looking back at our life, that's all that's going to matter. Did you fear God? Did you keep his commandments? Or did you try to climb the ladder? And did you forsake and neglect your family so that you could have more stuff? You know, so that's a good reminder for us to have vanity of vanities. You know, and there was a man that had more than we'll ever possess. And he was able to search for pleasure in ways that we'll never be able to. And his experience was, there's no happiness in that. Dave? It should be, and it sounds so simple when you say it, doesn't it? But yeah, you know, even myself, how oftentimes am I distracted by things of this world? How oftentimes, because I live in a world where, you know, Satan places temptation all around us in the form of materialism and in the form of comparison and all of these other things, it's hard to just stay so focused and stay on track and remember what's ultimately important. And I just have to bring myself back, and that's why discussions like this are really good for me, to bring me back to reality sometimes. You know, because we live in a world where material pleasures are a temptation, and you just have to remember why it is we're living for. We're not living for anything in this world. We're living to hear those words, "Enter in, thou good and faithful servant." So, good thoughts there, good discussion on that. Does anybody else want to add anything to that? Okay, this is the last question we've got, and we're going to... All right.
In verse 9, there it says that he had 30 sons and $30, and he gave his message and married outside his clan. Is that clan still Israelites, or is that possibly Canaanites?
I would have a feeling it's going to be Israelites. Clans are, as best my understanding, you have kind of a... You have tribes, you know, the 12 tribes, or however, the 12 tribes. And then within the individual 12 tribes, you'd have clans. And I think within the clans, you'd have families. And a couple of clans that come to mind, Gideon's clan, he was from the Abizrite clan, I believe. Manasseh's clan, he was from the Gileadites. Now, the Gileadites were part of a greater tribe, which was Manasseh, but they took up a greater portion of the clan of Manasseh. So my guess was he either... What verse was that? Verse 9? Okay. So he didn't, you know, he didn't keep it all in the family. And probably in a sense of networking to give him greater outreach, to give him greater influence over these son-in-laws that he brought in from other clans, whether he stuck to the same tribes or not, or for that matter, whether he stuck to the Israelites. I'm imagining just very strongly that he probably gave them in marriage to other Israelite clans. Can't say with certainty, but...
Some versions say abroad. They don't say...
Okay.
He says abroad.
Okay. Well, clans would definitely fall in with under abroad. So to what degree? Was it with the Israelites or was it with the Canaanites? We can't certainly say. Anybody want to offer any thoughts on that? It's possible. Like I guess maybe it's my desire to see the best in people, or to be a give them the benefit of the doubt. I say he did it within the Israelite clans. We can't say with certainty. The language seems to be to leave it kind of open to potentially others as well. So it's a good thought. Good question. All right, we'll pick up. I've got one more question. Question 7. I'm going to just go ahead and say this now. Wednesday night, look for questions in the back, because I'm going to forget to say it Wednesday, I know. So, and those will also be posted online for chapter 13, which we'll be moving into next week. So I thank everyone for their participation in our discussion this morning.